It's getting worse at J.P. Morgan, which has now lost $3 billion. That's a billion more than the bank said it lost last week after a series of bad trades. The Federal Reserve Bank is looking into the extent of these losses and the transactions that caused them. So is the FBI. And at least one investment fund with money in J.P. Morgan has filed a class action lawsuit against the bank. J.P. Morgan, meanwhile, says profits elsewhere will cover its losses. But last week's events have tarnished the reputation of the firm's CEO, Jamie Dimon, who is widely considered the nation's most highly reputed banking executive. The New York Times has called him the Obama administration's favorite banker. But now many commentators are saying that Dimon's fall from grace may be the best chance for stronger regulation of the financial markets. Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, is with us. Peter, the specifics of how this loss happened aren't entirely clear yet, but what do we know about those transactions and how they went wrong?
The chief investment office where the problems occurred is supposed to be a risk-reducing part of the organization, managing excess cash, making sure that the company's overall balance sheet is not taking on too much risk. But it seems to have gone over the past 5 years, as Bloomberg News first reported in April, from a risk-reducing part of the organization to one that actually took gambles in the pursuit of profit. And a lot of those gambles worked. In 2011, they were doing quite well. But the environment changed. They failed to change with it. They got caught behind. And then they desperately tried to, instead of just selling off a bad position, they tried to do a more complex hedge to kind of unwind it in a way that, you know, boggles the mind. And it just got too complicated even for them to manage.
You know, Jamie Dimon really got through the collapse of the financial markets untarnished, in part because his bank avoided some of the worst of that crisis. But this has been a very steep and quick fall. Could you give us his brief bio?
Jamie Dimon's 56 years old, handsome guy, fast-talking New Yorker. He started out as a protege of Sandy Weill, the famous guy who put together the Citigroup Travelers merger. Eventually had a falling out with Sandy Weill, two strong-willed men. He went off to Chicago as CEO of Bank One, which later merged with J.P. Morgan Chase, putting him a year later at the helm of that bank, which is now the biggest in the United States in terms of both assets and profits.
Dimon has also been very close to past and current members of the Obama administration, which suggests he was quite trusted by the White House.
Yes, as you mentioned in your intro, he came to be known as Obama's favorite banker. He's a Democrat. I think he supported Obama in 2008, not so sure he will in 2012, judging from his recent statements. At some point along the line, it's kind of funny, he seemed like he was alienated by some of the things that were being said. He didn't like it when Obama made a comment about fat cat bankers.
He took it personally somehow.
He took it personally. He certainly did, and he bristled at that. He didn't like the Dodd-Frank Act, which he thought was hemming in banks like his that didn't need to be hemmed in, and he really hated it when the Occupy Wall Street people marched up past his Park Avenue co-op.
Right. They put it on some tour, I guess, of, you know, fat cat
exactly.
Bankers.
Yes.
You mentioned Dodd-Frank. Is there a way to give us a simple overview, if that's possible, of the Dodd-Frank bill, which Congress passed almost 2 years ago?
One of the biggest financial reforms probably since the 1930s, with many, many parts to it, protections for consumers, rules to try to keep banks from getting in trouble again and imperiling, you know, the global economy. And one of the key planks in it is this Volcker rule, named after the former Fed chairman Paul Volcker. And it was aimed at keeping the banks from risking depositors by basically taking the money that they raise and speculating with it. It allows only very narrow exceptions for bank trading. Of course, people like Jamie Dimon would like to interpret the exemptions as broadly as possible.
Right. In fact, Dimon has spoken out forcefully against this proposal.
He has said that he supports the ban on speculative trading. The problem really comes down to how he defines speculative trading. He defines it in a way that is quite favorable to the bank's ability to continue to do the kind of trades that this chief investment office did.
Is his basic argument that this law handcuffs banks on the very basic of what they want to do, what their businesses are built on?
He likes to compare J.P. Morgan to a Walmart or a Costco. In fact, he's used those exact companies as comparisons, saying if a Walmart or Costco sells a polka dot dress and then nobody wants to buy it, the company takes the loss, and why should anybody else worry about that? And that they need to do transactions that will benefit their customers. He presents it as an argument that the freedom that they want is all about helping their customers. Of course, the critics say, no, it's not. It's all about enriching shareholders and creating bigger bonuses for the CEO and the top traders.
Right. And critics say sometimes the taxpayers end up holding the bag, because if the FDIC has insured money that's behind those losses, taxpayers suffer. So what does Diamond say about that?
Well, he says that in this case, for example, there's no danger at all to the FDIC because this is well within the bounds of losses that the bank can easily sustain. And he says even in the 2008 financial crisis, the J.P. Morgan was forced to accept capital by the government, didn't really need it. And he says that they're well capitalized, which is another way of saying they're financially strong, and that should be the bulwark. And as long as that bulwark is in place, things like the Dodd-Frank Act, the Volcker Rule are extraneous and even counterproductive.
But isn't there a concern that even within J.P. Morgan there could be more trades we don't know about that are larger and maybe could someday affect taxpayers?
Either at J.P. Morgan or some other bank. Remember, the reason that J.P. Morgan was such a strong voice is that it had done well. But the point is not that J.P. Morgan or Jamie Dimon was a bad executive. The point is that he was a good executive, and this still happens. So that's what tells you that there's maybe still more needs to be done to tighten up regulation to make the financial system more secure.
Right, this idea that even if the best of the best can get caught off guard and have these kind of losses, what about far from the best of the best?
Exactly, and that's what's made this fairly routine $2 billion trading loss into almost a morality tale for 2012.
Going back to Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, we've heard this phrase, Dimonfreude, play on words, of course, of Schadenfreude, finding joy in the misfortune of others circulating. But yet we also hear that really there shouldn't be Schadenfreude at all, because when Jamie Dimon is hurt, when his reputation is harmed, it affects the entire banking industry and increases the likelihood that it will be more regulated to its dismay.
Well, you have the community bankers, the small banks, were angry all the time that the big banks have gotten away with murder, that they're able to borrow more cheaply because they're seen as too big to fail. You have the hedge funds who traded against J.P. Morgan for years. And, of course, we have all the lawmakers who've been demonized by Jamie Dimon over the years. So there is some Schadenfreude here, probably understandably on the part of some. But as you say, it's not a good thing when a major bank discovers that its risk controls were not as good as they thought they were.
Peter, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the White House is stepping up talks with the Treasury Department to make sure the Volcker Rule doesn't get watered down. You mentioned the Volcker Rule briefly before the break. It's supposed to prevent banks from putting their depositors' money at risk. But could you give us a little more history on that?
Well, of course, Paul Volcker was the very highly respected chairman of the Federal Reserve, conquered inflation in the early 1980s by putting the economy through the ringer. And he he's a Democrat, but he still has a lot of respect from people across the financial sector. He's the one who said he doesn't think banks should be using money from depositors to speculate, that a bank should be a bank. A commercial bank should take deposits and make loans, and that's pretty much it. If you want to do investment banking, if you want to do speculative trading, oddball investments, be a hedge fund. And, you know, those are the people who make the big bucks by taking the big risks, but taxpayers and depositors should not be exposed to that kind of risk. And it's a fairly simple concept. It's the implementation that's incredibly difficult, and that's where we are right now, fighting over that.
The Volcker Rule is supposed to ban banks from trading with their own money. If it's not their own money, whose money is it?
Banks are still allowed to carry out trades on behalf of their customers when it's the customer's money at stake. There are even exceptions when they can do trading. It's called market making. For example, if your customer needs to buy, then you'll sell. And if the customer needs to sell, you'll buy. That's considered fairly routine. But it can easily lead to trouble because it's sometimes hard to draw the line between what's market making and what's speculation. Ditto with hedging. Hedging is when you create a risk reduction by offsetting one position with another opposite position. And that also can be easily abused by people who want to use it to speculate.
Is there a bookie metaphor here where you try to find one person to bet on one way and one person to bet the opposite to balance everything out?
Oh, we're comparing bankers to bookies, are we? I think that's fair to say, yes. That's the basic idea.
And Volcker is not yet in place, the Volcker rule, but it's still in play. It's being drafted, written, and considered.
Exactly. They went to work right away after the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010 to try to create rules to implement the Volcker rule. They finally came out with a draft proposal last October, and of course immediately everyone started taking pot shots at it. The comments run to thousands and thousands of pages. Regulators are reading through those comments now and trying to come up with a final rule in time for the two-year anniversary of Dodd-Frank, because the Volcker rule is supposed to take effect this July.
Many regulators are saying that even if it were fully written and implemented, they're not sure it would have stopped the kind of trades that are now losing billions for J.P. Morgan.
Well, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, one of the chief regulators of the banking system, has said that it cannot conclude, based on what it knows now, whether or not the transactions that J.P. Morgan conducted would have passed muster with the Volcker rule or not.
And all of this has reignited the debate over the Glass-Steagall Act, created in the 1930s, repealed in the 90s. It was set up to prevent banks from putting depositors' money at risk. Tell us a little more about that.
After some of the abuses that contributed to the Great Depression, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed in 1933 to separate commercial and investment banking. It's seen a way of reducing fraud and risk, and it stayed on the books until 1999 when it was repealed. Actually, oddly enough, in the aftermath of the deal by Sandy Weill and Jamie Dimon that created Citigroup from Citicorp and Travelers. So Jamie Dimon actually played a role probably in the dissolution of the Glass-Steagall Act. That is a structural separation, and it's another approach. It's a little different from the Volcker rule approach. It just says, not only do you ban commercial banks doing certain kind of activities, you don't even allow them to be in the same company as an investment bank. You just structurally separate them.
Is there a belief or a growing belief that repeal was a mistake?
Well, you can certainly find a lot of people who would like to reenact Glass-Steagall. I don't think it's the majority point of view yet, anyway. The usual comeback is, hey, look, the way banks got into a lot of their trouble was by making dumb loans, right? Dumb mortgage loans. We all are familiar with those. That could have existed even with Glass-Steagall.
So 4 years after the near meltdown of Wall Street, are we any safer than we were back then?
We are safer. The Dodd-Frank Act did put in some valuable changes that they're already helping us. I spoke to Barney Frank about this, actually, and he feels that the stronger capital rules, that is creating a bigger cushion of safety for banks, is important. There's a new provision that's intended to force even the biggest banks to be taken apart if they get in trouble so that they can't just claim to be too big to fail. And of course, there are new consumer protections, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and so on. So yeah, there have been improvements. Whether they're enough is another question, but there has been some movement in the right direction.
Peter Coy, I'm interested in your view as a financial journalist. Overall, has this J.P. Morgan situation been a good thing for the banking world because it exposes more problems that need to be fixed, or is there not much silver lining in this?
I think that if the losses were occurring, it's good that we know about them, because sunshine is the best disinfectant. It's better to have this come out now. It's almost like an inoculation, to switch metaphors. A small problem like this, well manageable, can possibly strengthen the immune system so that we won't have bigger problems in the future. So I'd say on net, so I'm glad we know about this. I'm not glad it happened, but I'm glad that if it did happen, we know about it.
So that's the optimist view.
Right.
Peter Coy is the economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.